Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis' Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx. Water's clear and my ears underwater, taller and hum from the car.
Disclaimer.
During this episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chanceability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking,
duh,
or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast. I'm Steve Mathis, and this is part two of the Dave Arnold podcast. If you haven't caught part one, go back in the archives and check it out. This is part two with a guy who, a very interesting man who was a mechanic slash team manager at Honda Factory and now R&D. Dave, we're going to go part two. Thank you for part one, by the way. I got some great responses from it.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve. It was a lot of fun, and I've had some people at work track me down and say they had a lot of fun listening to it.
Oh, cool. Hopefully you didn't get any in trouble. I think there was some four-stroke talk and two-stroke talk. And
no, it's so far so good, but never know.
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of left off last time we did this with, basically you were moving into a mechanic/manager role at Honda in the early 80s. I guess right off the bat, you worked for Roger in the GPs, Roger DeCoster, before he became Yamaha team manager. I wanted to ask you about that ribeye fork on that Honda. You know, that's a real interesting photo, and talk about working on that thing.
There was a Honda formed HRC in 1980, and the project leader's name was Mr. Miyakoshi, a real strong-willed, strong leader type of a character. And he wanted, Honda wanted to develop hardware and win races, and, I think they fell a little bit behind the ball in the second half of the 70s. And so they wanted like a 10-year commitment to kind of turn that around and develop hardware and try to create some winning momentum. And so this Miyakoshi really wanted Roger to, Roger still had a lot of good races in him, but he probably wasn't at that time still the dominant rider in Europe. I mean, he was getting a lot of competition toward the, and even Suzuki was still getting a lot of competition at the later part of the 70s from Mikola, Yamaha, and some other riders. And so, but in any case, Roger has always been, I'm sure he's talked about this himself, but Roger's always been very involved with the motorcycle and the hardware and the testing and the development. And I think Roger, not to speak on his behalf, but I think he had the feeling, he was still struggling to trying to find some kind of mechanical advantage and win Grand Prix. And he him and Raby Valentino, he was a kind of an inventor, creative technical guy from Italy, crazy Italian. And so they struck up a friendship, and Raby had this rudimentary, I call it a four-bar link. I don't think it's actually a four-bar link, but it's a parallelogram of sorts, you know, front suspension. And Roger started testing with Raby, I believe, in 79, early 79. I think he even ran it in a few Grand Prix. I don't think he ran it all season. But it was kind of a chromoly version of Reeve's original design, and it still had two Olean shocks at the time, I believe, one on each side of this linkage fork. So in any case, when Miyakoshi and HRC struck up a deal with Roger to be racing Hondas in 1980, Roger was very interested to continue that development, and he got Miyakoshi and HRC to kind of buy into it. I think it was more of a relationship that they would continue the development and try to evolve it, and if ever turned into production feasibility, there's all the licensing in terms of that agreement. I have any knowledge of it all.
Right.
But there's that picture that you see is a test fork that we had during the 82 season, but there was many generations of that Reeve fork where, you know, Honda made, they tried to get the weight out of the fork, you know, that was one of the disadvantages. Was probably the positives of that front end was the trajectory. The wheelbase was kind of adjustable. It didn't always get shorter like a telescopic fork. You could make the wheelbase not get as short under braking, transfer as much weight under braking. You could control the amount of dive, and it also had, you know, the evolution of rear suspension with decarbone shocks and all the load and all the leverage for the long travel created in the rear evolved, you know, the shocks to be quite a high level. So now you were sort of using that same level of rear suspension technology on the front. And it was from a damping and shock capability standpoint, that also was a big advantage for that system. So it had there's pictures. There was shocks on one on the right, one on the left, and then the picture of the Honda that I think you're talking about is they made some little rockers, and they put the shock up on the triple clamps behind the number plate. And there's some generations of that same design that where they tried to take the whole shock off of the front fork, and they had one in the backbone, and they had another one in the down tube, and just some hydraulic hoses. Ultimately, what that led to was the development of the cartridge fork that Honda kind of capitalized on and started racing in the early 80s.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I thought he did race GPs with it a little bit, right? I thought I saw a photo.
He did.
Yeah,
I'm sure I saw him with it at Carlsbad on a Suzuki. I know Donnie Hansen was kind of becoming our star guy in the 80s, and that's kind of when we had that bike with that suspension on it.
Right.
And he might have raced that bike, that picture the way you saw it, at, like, let's say an Anaheim Supercross or something like that.
Right.
We had also a rear suspension they call double pro link rear suspension, which is somewhat the same, but it's much more disguised. When you look at the bike, you can't really tell that it's got two rockers and two sets of linkages, but they had a rear suspension at the same time that Donnie raced halfway through the season, independently of when he raced that front suspension.
Oh, okay. Wow, cool. And then I guess the downsides would be that it was heavy and it had a lot of moving parts that could fail, I guess.
I'm speaking a little bit out of turn here, because at the same time they're developing this stuff, I mean, one, they're looking at the production feasibility. I believe it was heavy. I think also it had what they call a moment of inertia, or kind of a weight feeling. Physically, it wasn't super heavy, but, you know, a telescopic fork is relatively in line between the stem and the front axle, where that thing had a lot of, we could say, call it swing weight, right? Feel the weight, or that moment of inertia.
Yeah, right. So you wrapped up Roger's career, and I believe you talked about how he would have won the last two GPs of his career if it hadn't been for a DNF.
If he had a better mechanic. But he did go out with a win. We were scheduled to go to, I think it was Farley Castle in England. It was not a Grand Prix, but it was after the last race, and it was kind of a invitational race in England. And so he in Luxembourg, he ended up announcing his retirement and canceling that next race in England, and It was a big deal. I mean, they had lots of enthusiast press, and it was the last race of the year. And I think we might have talked earlier that it was kind of a challenging situation. Not only did Roger, you know, he wanted to finish the season on a win or maybe finish his career on a win, hopefully. But at the same time, the championship was coming to head, and it was a really close points race between Maller and Lackey. And Maller riding a Honda, and Roger's one of his key responsibilities was to ensure that Honda was going to win the championship, or he was going to do the best he could to help Andre with his chances of winning the championship. And so it's kind of like he had the ride of his life that day. I mean, he was the fastest guy on the track, but he also kind of had to be aware not to get in the middle of whatever was going on with Andre and Malurban Lackey.
So you wrap up that year, and then what do you become manager after that?
Almost directly after that. I don't know. We might have had like a month or some time off. I think Roger went vacationing in the south of France, and I might have packed everything up and got it sent back to the States. But as we got back to the States, you know, I was kind of on a leave of absence from, you know, I'm an American guy, and I work for American Honda, and, you know, so it was kind of a special arrangement that I was able to work directly for the factory, or HRC, directly while in Europe for this Grand Prix effort, and then I came back, and you know, Gunnar Lindstrom was the race team manager for the second half, or quite a few years in the 70s. And I think, you know, being in racing takes its toll on whoever's in charge, or mechanics and riders. It's kind of hard to sustain that type of lifestyle for a long period of time. So I think Gunnar was making plans to maybe not travel, talking to people about maybe not traveling as much. So they kind of shoehorned him into, I forget his role. I think it might have been power equipment.
Something.
something, you know, instead of racing. And then when I came off the roll, I was, you know, I mean, it was kind of a shock for me because I remember the top two guys at the time, it was Mr. Picasso and Mr. Shimizu, and he's like, okay, you're the manager, and we got to win, and, you know, we're going to ramp this thing up, and you know, and HRC and all the support, and immediately they said, you got to go out and get top guys. Well, Honda, you know, it's great that Roger was there, and it's great that I had a new job, but, you know, it really, Honda didn't have all the momentum in the States. You know, at that time, Suzuki had Barnett, and Hanna had, Yamaha had Bob Hanna, and Johnson and Glover, and, I mean, you know, I think Suzuki also had Ken Howerton. I mean, there was quite a few players, but they weren't in Honda. And we were starting from ground zero, really. I mean, the U.S., the Honda team at the time was pretty weak, not to offend anybody that was on the team at that time, but you know, as an overall effort. And so we had a lot of work to do.
So you went and really, you kind of subscribed to just let's find some kids, huh? Let's find some young.
It started out, they really wanted to hire Barnett. I think that Gunnar had talked with Ken Howerton the year before, but, you know, he had signed a multi-year deal again with Suzuki. And so they were trying to get Barnett, which it's kind of, I won't say it's unethical, but there was kind of a handshake gentleman agreement that nobody would hire each other's number one riders. But, you know, Honda was starting this big effort, and Barnett was available, and he was coming off of, I think, winning the championship in 79. I think Hanna had gotten hurt, and I think Barney was in full floater, the works bike Suzuki's. They were working really good. And so, you know, we talked to him. We had this big effort. Japan was involved. They were going to give better support. And it all looked good. And and Barnett was happy to. We kind of had a handshake, verbal agreement, or what do they call that? A
letter of intent or something.
We kind of have a letter of intent. And Suzuki got nervous and called them back in there. And Tosh, the manager at the time, gave him a whole bunch of money and locked them up and foiled our plans. And that was one of my first responsibilities given as a team manager, and I had quite a few people mad at me for botching the deal not playing out.
And you failed.
once again.
Barnett signed. I did one of these with Barnett. He said it was a 3-year $1 million deal, which that was huge back then.
Yeah, it was big. It was very, very big then, and, you know, not to get into who was making what, but nobody was making that. I mean, the Honda guys, you know, we didn't, you know, there was Marty that was the top guy in the early 70s. I mean, he was, I was a mechanic, so I'm not really even privy to what. But they didn't make lots of money. I mean, he made good money, and his family helped him invest wisely. But I think when the Yamaha guys started to beat on the guys, and maybe even Suzuki to some degree, you know, I think Yamaha started paying their guys pretty good, because Yamaha and Honda have always had a lot of friction or competitiveness, or you know.
Yeah,
they both. I don't know. Maybe they're number one and number two on different years, but they both wanted to stick it to each other.
As a former factory Yamaha mechanic for 4 years with McCarty and Oliver there, I can tell you there is a bit of a rivalry for sure.
There's deep blood. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's deep rooted with the Japanese, and it trickles into McCarty and his job and all the mechanics. It was corporate war. It was really corporate war. I mean, they weren't doing this recreationally. I mean, it was not just for grins. They really wanted results. I mean, if they were going to work with you and help develop hardware and answer the phone when you were calling, that was all good, but they wanted something for it, and they made it clear.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was like that at Yamaha. I mean, they everybody really wanted to make their mark at that point in time.
Yeah, right.
So, after not hiring Barnett, I'll be honest. I mean, Japan, the Miyakoshi, this new effort, you know, they were kind of frustrated. They wanted to hit the ground running. So, you know, we did the best we could, but, you know, I remember the thing on Donnie Hansen. I mean, Johnny O'Mara was riding for Mugen at the time, which was Honda's son, Hirotoshi.
Right.
So that was essentially somewhat of a shoe-in deal that he graduated to the works effort.
And he had won the GP anyway, so it was like...
He'd won the GP, so it was kind of all in line, you know. He was kind of in the fold or under the umbrella or in the family, however you want to. And so I remember coming off the road. Well, it wasn't even off the road. When the 500 Grand Prix in 1980 came to the U.S., you know, my brother and I, we all rode in the hills, and he was a dirt bike guy, and he followed the sport, and he'd gone, you know, local racing at Indian Dunes, and he goes, man, there's this Donnie Hansen riding for Colby on a Can-Am, and the guy, he's the top local guy, because, I had this new responsibility, and I think I mentioned to Gunnar, I said, my brother says Donnie Hansen looks good, and I think the very next L.A. Coliseum, Donnie Hansen had the ride of his life.
On a Can-Am.
He was, I don't know if you remember that race?
No, not, I remember Coliseum, a bunch of them, but not Hansen on a Can-Am.
Hansen was on a, and even Weinert, I think, was for a short period of time, but there was a local dealer in the Reseda, Los Angeles area named Andy Colby, actually, ironically, who I used to work for as just a street bike shop mechanic. But he had a racing background with some of the early guys, the Bud Eakins and Dave Eakins and guys like that, you know, Steve McQueen. He kind of hung around that group, but in any case, he had some local guys on Can-Ams and was trying to ramp up the Can-Am distributorship. And in any case, Gunnar went, you know, everybody in the world from Honda was kind of looking at Donnie because we had mentioned him, and then he had a good ride, and I think they locked him up right after that. So we were kind of scrapping for whoever we could get, but we didn't have any stars going into that 81 season. I think Roger had a pretty good relationship with Danny Laporte.
Mm-hmm.
I think he brought him in because, you know, Laporte's always someone that was kind of under the Roger umbrella when they were on Suzuki's through the 80s.
Right.
So we brought him in kind of last minute, and Chuck Sun, who had won the 500cc national champion, who was on the team.
Yep.
I think along with his brother Ron Sun, actually, in 1980.
Yeah, both the Rising Suns.
and so Chuck had won. Those are really good bikes in 1980. I think it was a 450 starting the season off, turned into a 476.
Uh-huh.
But in any case, Chuck was the reigning 500cc national champion going into 81. So it was essentially those four guys, O'Mara, Hansen, Sun, Laporte.
Yeah. And so then, decent season by everybody. They're kind of growing into it. And then the Motocross of Nations comes up. And America hadn't had a team for, I don't know, two or three years just because finances and getting beat or I don't really know. Talk about how that came together and everybody went together.
You know, so the team, you know, Japan's barely answering the phone. We're, you know, we're playing second fiddle all year long. I mean, but one thing we're doing is we're testing. We hired a trainer to help these guys. We were really trying to make them A-level. It was an A-level effort, and we were trying to get these guys the best support we could, develop the hardware. ProLink linkage suspension was new. I think we had options of air cooling and water cooling on some of the bikes. So, again, Japan didn't send us first string equipment just because we didn't have any star guys, and they weren't going to work that hard unless, you know, there was guys that could back it up. So, you know, Johnny was riding good. I think Chuck got beat in the 500 Nationals. We didn't really win any championships in the States. But, you know, O'Mara was doing pretty good in the 125 Nationals, and Hansen was starting to race and now compete with Hannah. Hannah's kind of coming off an injury, that leg injury that I'm sure everybody knows about.
Right.
So, I mean, we were kind of but it was the big break when I can remember it clearly. I mean, Dick, U.S. had a really hard time getting all these guys. There was real, real strong personalities, and there was the Bob Hanna hating the Howerton, hating the Weiner. You know, everybody,
Barnett,
they weren't all warm
you.
And fuzzy. Everybody was kind of into it for themselves and their factory effort. And
yeah,
it was a lot of, you know, the Europeans were fast, right? They have all the world champions. It wasn't fun. And typically when the Americans went over in the late 70s, it was Hanna wanted to show he was the top Yamaha guy, you know, over Heikki Mikkel. It was something like that, right? You know, it was a world stage, and I'm not saying they didn't want to do good, but the Americans didn't have a history of doing well at that type of an event.
Right, right.
So, therefore, I think the AMA couldn't get anybody interested to go in 81, and it was Keller that said he got real frustrated with the whole situation. And it was, I think, him talking to Roger and him talking to and I think Arthur Cohen from Bellray in Europe got involved, and I remember Roger asking me, what do you think? And of course, you know, I just come from Europe being his mechanic in 1980, and I thought, well, it would be a great idea. We don't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning, you know, Andre Vromans and all these guys. I mean,
Malaire,
you know.
Carlequist, Malaire, I mean.
My gosh, you know, I mean, the guys in Europe, I mean, you had Harry, Stefan's dad was still riding. I think Harry was still riding. And, man, you had some good guys, you know.
Yeah.
And especially, I think one of those races was in Lomel, and, you know, we didn't ride. Man, I didn't think, you know, especially guys from Southern California, except for LaPorte, like we had, I didn't view us as a very strong Grand Prix-level rough sand track type of a team, right?
Yeah, and that's a good point because, let's face it, none of the guys on your Honda team were the best American riders yet. And you were going to a deep, deep sand track. I've been to Lomel, so I can, you know, it's nothing like Southwick or anything like that.
I mean, you know, even when, you know, I got to experience, oh, it was great, in 1980, being Roger's mechanic. And, you know, I go to Lomel, we do set up the bike and Olean's and Kiaba and Joe and, you know, testing everything. And there was guys out there like Pierre Carmaker, right?
Yeah.
His brother, Toon, you know, with not even a factory effort, the shirt tails hanging out, and he's got like a chrome helmet, and they haul ass. I mean, I was in awe of these guys I'd never even heard of and how, you know, the level was pretty high.
That's pretty funny, Dave, because when we went to Lomel to test before the Motocross of the Nations in 03, and I showed up with Tim Ferry, who's from Florida and can ride the sand, and there was some dude with no numbers on an all-black Metal Militia bike that blew by him on a straightaway.
That's exactly right. And so, therefore, you know, and then, you know, on a world, I mean, Andre, there was just, there was two or three Belgians that were the level of Andre Vromans, and the same for the Germans, and the same for, you know, the English and the Italians. Everybody had, you know, two or three real strong guys. Maybe it was hard to get four guys every time from every country, but I mean, certainly we weren't that, you know.
And
these guys weren't even the no-name guys. And then I'm sure you've heard the stories how, you know, typically, I don't know if it's I don't know what type of consideration we're talking about, but it was acknowledgement that we were even a force or should even be there. You know, it's almost like, you know how bicycle teams get, they have to be selected or they have to be qualified for the Tour de France, right?
I didn't know but that.
You know, a little bit like that. You know, you had to actually officially be, you know, of that level to race an event like this. And, you know, the think we were kind of snubbed. Roger goes over there. Of course, Roger's Roger, and now he's in an advisory role or kind of coordinate and help me manage things. And I think he was pretty frustrated that you know, we were laughed off or whatever. It was kind of a joke, in I think, in the eyes of the Europeans.
And let's not forget people who are listening to this that don't realize it was 1 week was all 250s, and then the next week was all 500s. It wasn't
Oh, yeah. My gosh. The equipment, I mean, the containers we had, the equipment we had to prep and load and spare wheels, you know, of course, the different width, the different tires, the different gearing, spare engines. I mean, my gosh, it was our entire race shop went into some 747 containers.
So you ended up, you go there, and like you said, was it a lack of respect from the beginning once you're there? Is it just
your, I think, you know me, I think Roger and Arthur Cohn and those guys were, of course, those guys are much more engaged with the FIM and the press and all that, right? I mean, I'm just a worker, blue collar. I got to make sure everything works and everybody's on first. And, you know, I don't speak five or six languages like Roger and Arthur. So, you know, me, you know, I heard them make comments that Roger was all wound up, that they weren't giving him enough love. But, you know, for me, you know, I was still focused to try to do the best we could. I think everybody was.
Let me ask you this, because I don't really remember the results, but were you fast in practice, like right from the start? Was it like, hey,
you know what? There was, of course, Romans. I mean, they were fast in qualifying, and I remember being kind of nervous. I mean, the whole time, I didn't think we were going to win. I went in it, I hoping to have a respectable result, you know, and quite frankly, you know, the nice hotel that Delray put up and all the support that Dick Miller and the magazine drummed up, I mean, I was trying to just do that whole effort good, you know, but I didn't honestly think we were going to win. I think Roger had a better feel for, you know, maybe the team's capability, even though they weren't the level of guys from the States. I mean, maybe he had a little bit more, well, for sure he had a little bit more confidence than I did. I was like, you know, I had a lot of respect and knew how much talent there was over there. And, but to answer your question, our guys were fast in qualifying on Saturday. I think that was somewhat, you're lucky. I think it was a little bit laughed off. And I was more focused on problems. We were running air-cooled bikes. Still at that time, it was still thought that water cooling was too dangerous for Supercross and too heavy, and that hoses were going to break and people were going to get sprayed and burnt and outlawed, and you know, there was all this stuff. So and we had the option of going from air cooled to water cooled, and of course the water cooled bikes made more power, but ergonomically the tanks weren't quite as narrow, you know, all that stuff. But then there was still a controversy with the AMA and some of the regulations about, and even internally at Honda, whether or not we should truly commit to going that route or not. For professional racing, which ironically all the production bikes were going that way, right? So, but in any case, we had a problem in practice at Lomel. That's deep sand, and I remember it being damp sand, and, you know, damp, and that just sucks power. And they were air-cooled engines, and we had a bit of detonation. Trying to jet the bikes, and I think we even had all the bikes apart Saturday afternoon after practice, and we ran over to a shop, Chilkin. You remember the guy that invented the monoshock? And we ran over to this guy's shop and honed all the cylinders, and we had a real thrash going just to keep things alive. Got back late at night, put everything back together early Sunday morning. I mean, it was a big thrash.
Right. So on Sunday comes and you guys win the 250. The Trophy to Nations is what it was called.
Yeah, and again, you know, it was one of these things where it was, you know, one or two of the guys did really good, you know, but it wasn't a slam dunk because it stayed until the very end of the last moto. It was still up in the air between, I believe it was England, Belgium, and the United States.
Okay.
And
all right.
Yeah. Man, I'm telling you, Roger was running around and trying to calculate the points, and I think he had somebody helping him do that, but, you know, I was trying to, you know, I wasn't doing the math, right? I was just kind of following orders at that point in the game, but, oh, man, it was, we were on cloud nine. People were excited. We were wound up. It was, it was too good to be true, and it was totally unexpected. It wasn't, I think on all fronts, especially mine, I mean, it was you know, it was a diamond in the rough kind of a deal.
You know, Dave, from history now, it would be much cooler if you were like, I knew we were going to win. I knew we were.
Yeah, you know, I wish I've never, I mean, even when we got a pretty good record going and a lot of momentum in the 80s, but I really never tried to be that. I mean, I really tried to stay humble as much and keep your finger on who was hungry and who wasn't. And, you know, it's Roger and I talked quite a bit. I think he's like that by nature as well. I mean, I don't take anything for granted. Even when things look good and in fact, they're playing out pretty well, you know, anything can turn around and turn bad at a moment's notice. And,
right.
You know, I don't know. At that point in time, I was, oh, man, it was exciting. Everybody involved, I mean, the first year, the Americans, and then the Americans beating the Europeans. And, and also within Honda, when we came back, you know, man, it took a while even to settle in, you know. Yeah, we won this big race, but I remember the next big race was at Unadilla, and I remember Ward Robinson said, okay, and we had all these wreaths and trophies and all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And it just happened to be in some of the containers that were shipped back to New York, and we were in the box van, and they had a pickup truck drive everybody around and wave to the crowd, and they had all the trophies, and they made it this big hoopla, right? And people were freaking out over the whole deal. So, well, and then also within Honda, all of a sudden, you know, yes, we didn't have, you know, we hadn't won championships, but now we have that, right? I mean, it's almost like we earned respect. I mean, America won respect. The Honda team won respect.
Yeah.
We got, you know, day late and dollar short, even some respect from Japan. Okay, well, we bet you deserve, we'll give you bikes next year again. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And where was the next week, the 500 race at?
Yeah, I'm going to say Gaeldorf.
Oh, okay, Germany. Yep.
I think I was in Germany. I'm pretty sure it was the track of Gaeldorf. And
did that go easier?
And yeah, it was crazy because, you know, what was crazy about that is, I mean, none of these guys, or let's say, I won't say none of these guys, but Johnny, I don't know that Johnny had ever ridden a 500 before that event. And he was right in the middle of it. He was a star guy.
Yeah.
Johnny was a 125 fan in the clutch, you know, high RPM, you know.
Yeah.
And here he was on a 500, and he had a respectable ride. I think the 500 win went even a little bit easier, or it fell into place, or they had more of a margin than even the 250. The 250 was probably more of a crapshoot. The 500, even maybe it was their confidence level. I'm not sure what, but it was a little bit more of a solid performance. Even
the and the Euro guys after the 250 were like, ah, that's okay. We are 500 specialists. We'll show them.
Exactly right. And man, the Americans went on the 500. I mean, I don't think, and they weren't even the guys, right? And it was a big deal. And I even think it took a long time. Of course, the impact at that time was big, but I think it even, maybe in hindsight, or maybe even as weeks and months played out, it turned into a bigger deal as, you know, the press started to reflect on, wow, they beat our world champions, you know, they beat our 500. The 500 Grand Prix was the premier series in the world, right? It wasn't 250 Supercross United States, you know, it was 500 Grand Prix, and all of a sudden you got some 125 punk kid out of, you know, Van Nuys, California, and, you know.
Probably can't even kick over a 480.
Exactly. So.
Okay, you win in 81, and Dave Arnold proves that he's the greatest manager ever. And And you go to 82. You 82. The team Hansen captures the Supercross and Outdoor title in pretty unexpected form, right? I mean, he was on it that year.
Donnie Hansen was on. It was also
you signed Bailey.
A very closely contested series.
Yeah.
I think we had hired we had a support guy that did really well that year too. I'm almost sure that was 82. But we had Kenny Keel on out of Florida. I think Schultz got hurt at the last minute, and we put Kenny Keel on a support guy, and he led the national series. He won the first race in Gainesville, and that was either 82 or 83. But I mean, he led for almost half the series, and then when it got to the West Coast and hardpack, then all of a sudden, you know, he wasn't as strong on the clay tracks. But it ended up at the end of the series. It was Ricky Johnson and Barnett. I think. Was sort of in it, but Barnett was having some physical problems, I believe, with his knee. Hannah was, I believe, injured off and on. And it ended up, Ricky Johnson was kind of the Yamaha support guy, you know, and Bob and Glover and these other guys were more of the works riders. And there was, anyway, it came down to, I think, at Castle Rock, Colorado. And Ricky kind of had a points advantage, but he overjumped a jump. And broke his wheel, and that ensured Donnie the title. And Donnie went on and won both titles that year, Supercross and National. And then we go into Trophy to Nations, and it's a completely new team. Unfortunately, Hansen gets injured in practice before that event, and then the lineup changes. I think Bailey was flown over the last minute.
Yeah, what was... Well, Hansen would never race again, really. Career-ending crash. What did he do? Were you there? What happened?
I was there. Essentially, I was there. It was a practice track, and you send over all the equipment. Everybody gets the truck and the gas and the oil, and everybody. So let's say it's like a Thursday before the event on Saturday, and we went to a local practice track in kind of somewhat south of Germany.
Yeah.
I think down towards Stuttgart, but it wasn't that far. And it was a small town, and these guys were... And I remember, of course, Magoo, Gibson, Donnie Hansen, and Johnny. And I remember those guys just going out on the track. And then I ran into town to get... Nobody had lunch, and I went in to get some bread rolls and some drinks and some ham and cheese or I don't know what. And I came back, and Donnie had crashed in the whoops. I don't even think they were... really warmed up. I think everybody was just kind of getting going, and I think I was in town, and somebody came and told me that they called an ambulance, and that Donnie had crashed really bad.
Oh yeah, that yeah.
Maybe. And it wasn't. I don't think it was. You know, almost like the Bailey thing. They weren't real big, giant X game. You know, type of big crashes. You know, I think Donnie just. You know, there was a whoop section kind of in front of where we parked the truck, and I think he mistimed it, and he just when he fell off the bike, he just happened to land on his tailbone incorrectly, and that's what did it. You know.
Yeah. Wow. Shocker for sure. That coming weekend, Magoo sweeps all four motos 2 weeks in a row in probably what has to be one of the greatest rides of all time. Right.
It was crazy because the whole Magoo thing. I mean. There was a lot of the industry, other riders, even people within our team. It's like nobody really knew what to make of Magoo. I mean, we had snatched him, kind of put him under our wing. I mean, we worked with Lorenz Offner, the LP manager, which was kind of a Honda support effort at the time. And Magoo was doing unbelievable on a production. I think it was 480 in the first half of the year. Then we got him, made a deal with Lorenz to give him some different support or some different riders or something like that. Made some arrangement. And then we put him on the works effort, and the guy was unbelievably fast. But people were scared of him, you know? I mean, they didn't know what to make of him. They didn't know if he was crazy or talented, and that's the honest truth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even the people... If you were a spectator, it had to have been the best thing ever to watch because never has anybody just run on that ragged edge the entire time.
Crazy that he just goes out. I mean, he was fast in America, but he hadn't necessarily established himself, and then he just goes out and beats the world's best badly.
And again, you know, the U.S. and Honda, they bring this team that wasn't even star guys in 81.
Right.
And then in 82, it's also, except for Donnie Johnny Hansen, who just got in. Okay, now the guy that did win national level championships got injured. So,
yeah.
And who is Magoo, right?
Right.
That doesn't even, the only Magoo they know is the cartoon character. And Magoo was unbelievably fast.
Well, yeah, I would love to see video from that event. I saw there's a photo of MXA, just a classic photo of the start, and he has to be 20 bike lengths ahead of everybody.
Magoo, I remember he lined up for those races without a chest protector. Roger's like, you know, running through the pits. Danny, you forgot your chest protector. And he's like, I'm not going to need it, you know.
Really?
And,
huh?
Nobody did. It was, you know, that track, it's a pea gravel track. No, you don't do that, right?
Right,
I mean,
right,
it's like...
Right.
It's like running around behind a shotgun when you know, yeah. The 500cc works two-stroke.
I'm not going to need it. That's awesome.
I'm not going to need it. And I mean, I remember Magoo being so on that he would say, and he has so much just focused energy, and, mm-hmm. and he's like, don't let those other guys hold me up. And that's not to be disrespectful, but, I want to get out front. I he wanted to do some damage.
You
and,
guys are like, what are you talking about?
I remember the 250 race, you know, and we said, okay, you know, we'll tell the other guys where your position is. And, you know, all you guys, Danny's got really good lap times in practice, so if he yeah. comes up, you know, not just Danny, like any team member,
yeah.
like he would for a race like that, of course you're looking at the overall effort.
Right.
And the overall goal, and it's not totally for the individual. You kind of, if somebody else is coming through, we'll give you a sign and cut each other some slack. And then it's, you know, we're more focused on beating Belgium and Germany and
yeah.
England and all these Holland and all these other guys, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't the second lap. Maybe it was the first lap. Danny's going through the mechanic area, one hand on the handlebar, pointing at Johnny or David, and frantically like, get him out. You know, I gotta go, right? I mean, he was just crazed. And
wow.
man, he was fast. And I don't want to, you know, this story doesn't really get better over time because, you know, now the other riders had never seen that type of riding style. They'd never seen anybody go that far off of jumps. They'd never seen anybody, in their eyes, ride that unsafe or crazy. I mean, those guys were, they were, there was somewhat of a, more than a concern. There was kind of a protest from a lot of the Europeans, like, this guy's crazy and someone's going to get hurt, right? It was,
well, that's what I was going to ask you.
So
that's
I remember
a true story.
There's a picture, I believe it is Andre Vromans again, and there was a big uphill, and then they rounded the top of the hill, but they get a lot of air, and there was a tree on the backside. And I remember in practice, David and Johnny, you know, they were saying, you cannot believe what Magoo's doing, how much air he's getting off this thing. And so Magoo asked Roger to have the FIM trim the tree. And so they trimmed the tree. And I never went back there and looked at it. But the other riders are like, you can't. There was a picture of Magoo, even after the tree got trimmed, and he was like a... so far up in the air over Vromans, and Vromans was on the ground looking over his shoulder in sheer, I mean, the guy just didn't want to get hurt. Forget about winning the race,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
And Magoo was all, you know how he did the big pancake thing?
Right,
and
right.
And he's got the thing, he's completely laying on the gas tank trying to miss his tree. I mean, he would have gone even harder, jumped farther if that tree hadn't have been, you know, if it hadn't have been there.
Just incredible ride, no doubt about it.
It was unbelievable, and that really sealed the deal. I mean, again, who is Magoo? We don't even know. They were flabbergasted. It just seemed like it was the 1-2 punch, the Americans coming and not their top guys, and they did it again, and who are these guys? And that the second year, and it was four motos, and it wasn't who was this guy, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was that sealed the deal. That really put the American, I think, established their position and their level worldwide against something that had been traditionally, the European Grand Prix effort.
And then he gets stung by a bee, I guess, and it has to get...
So I come back in, and I think it was after the second moto, and there was a FIM official, and there was a nurse dressed in the white. I mean, she was out of the ambulance, and she's holding a syringe. And there's an FIM official holding her arm so that she can't give this. Obviously, it was an antidote for the bee sting, right?
Right.
And he thought Magoo was on drugs, and this was some kind of an antidote. And, you know, he didn't buy the whole bee sting. I mean, Danny, he was down to his underwear, and he grabbed. I remember he was just going crazy because, you know, whatever the reaction is, yeah, after if you're allergic and you get stung, and he grabbed out of Clif or Crippa their a wire brush, and he was itching his skin. I mean, also like a madman, right? Yeah, and he's just shredding his skin because it had this breakout or this hive or this, you know, rash. And I was like, I was starting to believe the FIM or the Europeans at that point in time. I was like, oh my God, what have I got myself into here, you know?
So funny.
But, you know, I think Roger explained the situation, and finally, you know, and it, you know, it truly wasn't meth or heroin, or, you know, it was truly some kind of a bee sting, and I know he got the whole thing straightened out.
Funny. So you go, you in 82, you sign Bailey, you got O'Meara. Now 83 comes around, and you sign one of the winningest riders of all time, Hannah, who was, at that point, throwing his Yamahas down, talking crap about Yamahas in all the magazines.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, he was fed up over there. How did that come about, signing Bob Hannah?
You know, I'll be honest, and I'm not trying to say that, but I want to say this because, you know, O'Meara was a super talented rider, and Bailey was a super talented rider, and even Jeff Ward. I think Roger and I sensed there was a trend of like a really high skill level rider between like a Ward, O'Meara, and a Bailey, and I can't remember one or two other guys, but I mean those guys, you know. They started to feel like they could win championships if they would just be consistent and finish top five. And we were getting a lot of pressure from Japan to dominate. I mean, that was the Japanese, that was their character. I mean, they didn't understand getting second and third, right? And the riders, they wanted to win championships. They really felt like being consistent and not getting injured for the entire season, you know, and there was a lot of validity to that, right?
Right.
And I think that, on the other hand, we were afraid if there was another guy coming into the sport in their prime, like a Hannah, or I think at the time it was like a Ricky Johnson, that, you know, I think we believe that attitude, in the end, truly prevails over talent, right?
Right.
I don't know, it's just like a general belief that, and that was the appeal for Hannah. You know, yes, he was over the hill, we knew he had some races in him, but it was, we just wanted to get some of that attitude in our team, you know, and have it rub off on O'Meara and have it rub off on Bailey. And I'm not saying that to slam O'Meara and Bailey. I mean, we were trying to do it to capitalize on their strengths and hopefully supplement their strength and create an overall, I remember the first contract negotiations with Bob, and I think we were paying bonuses for, let's say, three positions and sometimes five positions, and I don't know, because we weren't used to winning, you know? We'd pay just to get, just to be up in the running, just to be on the podium, we'd almost pay money, right?
Yeah.
And Bob was like, he should have been the team manager. He goes, I think you guys are you're crazy for paying people to get beat. He goes, take all that money and put it on first. I mean, Bob would not allow his contract to be written to where he was rewarded for anything but first.
Wow.
But he wanted all the eggs in that basket, right?
Yeah.
And that's just an example of how it was the entire season. I mean, Bob was cocky like Bob's never been and limpy. And, you know, I remember a press conference down in Florida that we did, and Bob was going on about how nobody had a chance, and you'd have to let all the air out of everybody's tires for it to be close, and, you know, the only guys he was going to be racing with was O'Meara and Bailey, and they were going to be racing for second. They weren't, you know, but it was, you know, you still had, I guess it gets back to that, I'm by character a little bit more humble, right? I still respected our competitors and the other factories, and I knew their true capability, right? I mean, we didn't have, you know what I mean? You're never that dominant. We weren't that dominant. But Bob, you know, and I remember asking him, I said, man, you know, I mean, there's other guys that can win this race. It was before the Daytona Supercross.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, if we don't back up, or let's say you don't back up, I mean, when you come off with being this cocky or confident, and you really have a bad day. I mean, doesn't that make you look bad or us look bad? Like,
right.
And Bob goes, that's exactly why I do it. And this was in confidence.
Right.
We were driving in a rental car back to the hotel after this press conference, and that told me a lot about Bob. He said, Bob didn't want to look like a fool, but look how many fans. I always tried to study. I go, why is the guy so popular? And Bob had a huge fan base. And I think that's exactly the reason that even if Bob was back in 12th or 10th or 8th, everybody was looking at him, right?
Right.
Everybody, he'd be flipping somebody off or doing, I mean, he'd be coming through the pack and he'd be giving you 120%. And,
yeah.
And Hannah was very instrumental in not only winning a handful of races, unfortunately getting some injuries along the way, but I think helping Bailey and Amara win championships.
Yeah. We touched on this last show and, Bob Oliver told me that Hannah was the fastest guy in 83. He just got hurt. You know, he would have won.
Yeah.
Both titles, was flying.
Yeah.
Whatever he raced, he was winning.
Yeah.
You know? But just injuries. But, Bailey's written about it a few times, how he looked at Hannah and was like, wow, that guy, he works hard, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Bob works hard, and Bob doesn't make excuses. And that's exactly what we wanted in the team. We didn't want this picnic. You know, we weren't on a picnic. You know, it was war, and we needed somebody that had that killer instinct. And even if he wasn't the guy that was going to stay healthy all year, I mean, to me, Bob was worth his weight in gold. And I didn't feel that way when I worked for Marty Smith and we were racing against him in the 70s, but I did in the early 80s when he was on our side helping those guys.
Funny how that works. And then also too, can you imagine for Hannah getting off a works Yamaha with the radiator on the handlebars versus a factory Honda lowboy tank, just the latest, greatest thing. I mean, he must have just been in heaven, too. That bike was – your bikes were starting to come a long way right around now.
You know, Japan was – I mean, it was truly things were coming together. Anybody that comes out of the era, you know, a lot of people have a tendency. Every team's hard to maintain that level of commitment, that level of momentum, because a lot of people start looking at, well, I'm the ingredient. There was a lot of elements. I mean, Roger was a big asset, and I think him and I worked really good together for, the coordination, the focus, the testing, the riders. I mean, a lot of the development was done on our side. I think that we had a very good relationship with Japan. I mean, Japan with their commitment toward works racing. I mean, with HRC, they had engineers that were, doing engine development for all three classes and willing to work with us. I think they used us quite a bit for some of the dynamic stuff that wasn't such a pure science. Chassis balance, suspension, link ratios, all that stuff. I mean, the level of racing obviously was higher in the U.S. than it was domestically for those guys. So I think we had a lot of influence on the development of suspension systems and chassis.
Right, right.
But I remember the first time that 82 bike showed up with that low boy tank, I'm like, I don't know about all this, right? I mean, I'm probably a little bit of a traditionalist, and I mean, I like to, but I'm telling you, man, that bike was a good bike. That was the best works bike advantage I believe we ever had.
In 82,
In 1982. Those bikes were unbelievable.
Well, Lachine says his 85 125 was on another level, too.
That's probably a fair statement. I think anything prior to 86.
Yeah.
Although I got another story about 85 bike and Lachine, but I'll tell you later.
Yeah, well, I want to touch on Lachine. You had him. I hired him for 84. He lost a bitter war with Johnson, who was riding a production Yamaha at the time. And then in 85, you put him on 125, and he just kills everybody. And then, of course, we know what happened after the season in 85.
Yeah, I mean, It reminds me of a lot of these all-star teams that they put together for basketball or baseball,
right,
or some of the other sports. And you got all these star guys that maybe they know each other. Obviously, they've competed against each other. But that's kind of what our 85 team was. I mean, we really didn't have room for another guy. And putting Lachine in there was a last-minute deal. We actually had talked to Brian Myerscough about being on the team. And I got to say, I had more than a commitment, verbal commitment with him for that to play out. But other factors, you know, I think Lachine was viewed as a talent, you know, like a Hannah, somebody that could be around for a while. And right. Everybody was afraid of that back then. I mean, you know, if you remember, like, a Bob, he had a dominant run for, like, you know, 3 or 4 years, and then Barnett, and then, you know what I mean, right. And then Howerton, and, you know, and then Donnie. We were really, like, we had a lot of pressure on us to win, and so the Lachine came. Probably it was too much talent, and we started having personality issues. I won't say person. That's kind of vague, right? But, I mean, there was definitely a difference in character between, like, Lachine and Amarin Bailey, and there's always a chemistry within the team that helps the total ambience, right? The total... I would say we upset a little bit, and...
Hannah was probably disgusted with Ronnie.
You know what? I gotta. You know, this is one of the things where when the kids are out playing and the parents are naive, and I heard probably rumors of, you know, the guy wouldn't practice, and we give him practice bikes, and they'd come back looking brand new, right?
Right.
And everybody would make. You know how I'm probably the last one to know, right? I mean, you know, maybe the mechanics know, and maybe the other riders know, but nobody's gonna rat him out. And you know, I don't know how effective I was at. You know, Ronnie, you got to straighten your act out. I mean, I was probably more focused on the technical stuff and make sure the bikes and, you know, making sure we had some kind of a mechanical advantage. And
right. That
was maybe what my general character and background. And if I did that and we truly had a better mousetrap, well, then it was easier. And then maybe those guys indirectly felt pressured to perform because, you know, everybody else is working hard.
Yeah, exactly. Those
But the Lachine thing, I mean, gosh, what a talent. And I don't have to say big talent gone bad, but, I mean, it's one of those things where, man, on any given day, that guy could run away. I watched him. There was a dash. There's 100 stories like this, but when Lachine was on, I mean, he was so smooth, and he was so fast and fluid, and, you know, but I think it was his lifestyle kept him from winning championships or being consistent. So.
Well, he won one for you guys.
That's right.
And what was the story about the bike? What were you going to say?
No, the story on the bike was in 95. So, of course, they have production regulations slated for, I'm sorry.
85.
85. And production regulation was slated for 86. And our 95, the production bike was going to have a power valve on it. We, up until that point, we had the attack system where
right. It
had a plenum chamber on the exhaust pipe. And it actually, on some bikes, it worked pretty good. But overall, we thought the Yamahas made a little bit more torque and had a little bit more...
Mm-hmm.
Controllability, you know, low RPM response. And so then we were trying to get Honda to come up with something competitive or superior to that. So they, you know, when the production, they had to come up with a base for that system, and they did so in the 85 bike, and it was an electronic power valve. It was a square broach valve that changed the port time, exhaust port timing, and exhaust port volume. But this one was electronically controlled to where it had less friction than the mechanical system, and
right. Had
a Japanese engineer programming it with a laptop on opening and closing and the speed, and it was like Formula One racing to the industry at the time, which,
yeah. You
know, didn't have chips and computers and all that stuff, right?
Right, yeah.
So they get these bikes, and I remember Lachine, typically all the riders in the beginning of January, we planned to go to warm-up races or some of the Golden State races, some of the Stu Peters CMC or whatever, right, just to shape things out. And get, you know, a lot of times people get arm pump in January. That way you're ready for Anaheim or whatever the first race is. And Lachine was like, these things are so unbelievably fast. I don't want to go to any of the races and show people the advantage we have. And he got kind of everybody else to buy into that. I mean, they were the most expensive, the most exotic, and but I'm still one for trying to shake things out and making sure that, you know, reality follows the fantasy, right?
Right.
And in any case, and it's hindsight, so it's easy to say, but that year, again, we probably had, well, for sure we had the most expensive bikes, and we had the most talent for riders with four top-level guys, including Ronnie, Bob, David, and Johnny.
Yeah.
But I don't think we won anything that year.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a year like, I'm sure you've heard stories when they develop fuel injection, trying to get controllability and linearity and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though on a dyno it does something really nice, but in reality, there was Bailey looped out in one of the super, I think it was Atlanta, Georgia, the right-hander coming out of a rut, and the thing came on so fast, and he was laying on the ground before he even started to roll the throttle off. And Ronnie did the same thing in when racing Ward for the championship in the Rose Bowl.
Yeah.
And there was almost issues of it was too good to be true, and it was. We didn't, it wasn't really, it was a good development tool, but
yeah,
it didn't really win championships.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Now it's time to pay some bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at btosports.com.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that because I've done these with Bailey and Dogger, and Lachine's a friend of mine now. I could bench race with the guy for days. And as a fan, the 85 Hondas were the trickiest bikes ever. But both of those guys said, our bikes were better in 84, you know?
Yeah, they were.
That's
yeah.
funny that, that's funny that it works out like that.
Yeah. You know, it's a real quick comment. You know what's funny about the 84 thing was there was a I'm not a world economist. Again, I don't balance my own checkbook. The wife does. But I'll make this comment that there was a and people in racing don't know about the problems of sales and marketing and business, right? But there was a recession in the early 80s.
Right.
And I remember having to go to Japan, negotiate with the factory about, well, we got to spend less money on hardware. So there was kind of like an A level of hardware, because we had four guys, and a B level of hardware, right?
Right.
So, you know, going into the 84 season, I think Johnny, you know, I think Bob, of course, ended up like, he had the magnesium engine cases, and he had all the high-level stuff. And I think Johnny had engines that were based on production crankcases and based on production crankshafts. And I think they were somewhat trying to get ready for production regulations in 86. But at the same time, it was a cost-cutting measure, right?
Right, right.
And so they were only like a half-works bike. Well, Johnny ended up beating everybody in Supercross that year. He was dominant. Yeah. He ran away from everybody. And I always got kind of a kick out of that he beat all the trick bikes or the expensive bikes.
And was that rider choice, or was more like, hey, Hannah's our...
No, it wasn't rider choice.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it was, and it's hard to manage that. I mean, Roger and I always wanted everybody to feel that there was no favorites, that there was no biases, and we were really against having a two-tiered equipment thing. It put us in a difficult situation.
Right, right, for sure.
You know, this guy gets the magnesium and all the special parts coming from Japan, and oh, by the way, you're running the production parts, you know?
Yeah, and then
Not entirely. I mean, it was obviously warmed up with a lot of the same cylinder specs and exhaust pipes and carbs, but the base was more production.
And the 85s had a fuel pump, did they not? An electronic fuel pump in them?
85 fuel pump.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them had any bike that had a low gas tank.
Yeah.
It had a vacuum fuel pump.
Okay. Yeah.
That ran off the pressure of the crankcase, and then there was a subchamber, and it pumped gas to the top, and gravity fed back to the carburetor.
Yeah.
That's what was required to run a gas volume or gas tank that was at least the same level or even a lower level than the carburetor.
Right. What?
I don't remember the electronic fuel pump, but you're probably right.
Yeah. I could be wrong. You're Dave Arnold. I'm just a fan.
No, I don't know. But, Dave Arnold is now. You know, when you get my age, you start forgetting things too.
What about this twin cylinder 125 that O'Mara told me he rode? Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, there was all kinds. You know, it's funny when you know you're running this race effort and you think you're going to get all the cool stuff, right? But there was a lot of one-off prototype conceptual works bikes built and tested at that period of time. There was two cylinder 125s that were tested. Probably even a race in Japan Championship for a few events. There was two-cylinder 250s, same deal. After Yamaha came out with a rotary valve, 125 Honda came out, you know, which was the problem with the rotary valve is, you know, everything, the engine's wide and the carburetor's on the side and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Honda had a prototype where the rotary valve was on the back of the motor. That was right before we went to K Street engines, but they were trying all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
automatic too. An automatic 250.
They also had an automatic 250.
Or do you not want to talk about it? Is that am I?
No. Okay. It's fine. It's fine. I mean, it's actually a lot of that technology. You know, so the discussion then was that you know, this motocross thing was growing in popularity, mm-hmm. and, you know, off-road, I mean, still XR sales were doing pretty good at the same time for people riding in the desert and off-road, but I think the Japanese were concerned that it was still, it's kind of like doing extreme sports now, like it was too narrowly focused, too much of a niche. I mean, how many guys, you know, how user-friendly is it? I mean, yeah, the cool kid on the block knows how to pop wheelies and do slides and shift and clutch, but then, you know, it would be more of a mass-market bike if they could develop an automatic, and the average guy didn't have to coordinate all that stuff, right?
Right.
And just turn the throttle. They thought it would be it'd be more appealing and more effective and more user-friendly for a bigger base.
Right.
And so they developed this automatic concept, and it sucked a little bit of power, of course, having that type of transmission. That transmission is very similar to what they ended up running on one of their ATVs years later.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But that thing was pretty trick. They could change the gearing on that thing by electronically changing a chip, and they could make it an off-road bike or a motocross bike.
Right. Okay.
And they had a little shift lever on it to where it wasn't all automatic. You could kind of override it if you wanted to downshift and use the engine more for a brake and things like that.
Was that the coolest thing you've ever seen, or was there
the automatic?
Yeah.
It was. I mean, you know, there's a lot of times. I gotta be honest. Like the novelty of two-cylinder 125s. I mean, to a pure engine guy like Cliff White, he loved it. You know, he was one of our best mechanics, if not the best mechanic ever. I mean, he was Jean-Michel Bale's mechanic and Bailey's mechanic and George Hahn. I mean, he's won more championships for Honda. But he loved that stuff because he was an engine guy and the high RPM and all the stuff. And I don't know, they were irritating to me. I mean, you could hardly hear them shift, and they just sounded, they were at like 16,000 RPM the whole time.
Right.
And I was like, man, what's it going to be like having a whole track full of these things? And and then the automatic, maybe it's a little bit of an elitist comment, but, you know, if people don't know how to shift, you know what I mean?
Right. You're like, just shift it.
Just freaking learn how to use the clutch and shift. I mean, I remember my brother never really was that effective riding dirt bikes, and I always got kind of a kick out of that because that's the challenge of being really good riding a dirt bike, right, is to be able to coordinate and do all that. So I don't know. I mean, I thought it was neat, but I didn't. You know, I was surprised it actually went in at a pro level. I think some of the guys were reluctant to race it. For one reason, it of course, it's a totally different riding style.
Right.
But I remember Bailey finally won a Supercross on it in Japan. Not Bailey, Jean-Michel Bale.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't want to ride it anymore after that, and he was a really good test rider, and he had him refine it in a couple, three or four different ways, and then he finally won a Supercross, and they wanted him to campaign it, whether it be in the States, or they really wanted the thing to get, more mileage and more development. He's like, no, if I can't do this full time, and if this is not the way, you know, it's going to ruin my whole technique and my whole riding style. But, I mean, Bailey, you didn't have to put your foot down on the corner. It did a lot of things really good, right?
Right, yeah.
So
let me ask you this. If Lachine doesn't get busted for drugs in Japan at the end of 85, does he come back to Honda, or was that a tipping point where you guys were like, all right, we're not having you on the team?
No, I think that was a formality. I mean, of course, you know, it was a totally big deal for this to happen in the first place, and for that to happen in front of the Japanese and all the management. I mean,
that was
in uncertain terms, you know, I had to drive out there with one of the executives from HRC and pick the guy up, and he wasn't happy about leaving work and especially for that type of an issue. Yeah. And I think Honda had to post a bond or do something, right? And then they told me that I had to ship them home the next day, and that, you know, maybe they'd had conversations, obviously, with American Honda, but I was told by whatever management I was interacting with in Japan that I had to fire them and send them home.
And that was it.
So I had to do all that. But again, it was a bit of a formality because you know, he'd already been talking to Roy Turner about racing the Kawasaki the following season, so it didn't change fate that much.
So then you hired RJ in 86, and what a find that is. Again, production rule, which everybody thought was going to bring Honda down, production rule comes in, and you guys show up with still the best bikes in the class. And
'86 was, you know, if I said '82, and a lot of the worst bikes in the early '80s were the best that we ever had, and the '86 production bike was all of them, all the development from Japan. Those things were unbelievable. I mean, we also, Mickey Diamond won the 125 Nationals, and that thing ran like a 250. I mean, he rode really good. It was kind of it was totally unexpected, I think, that he could win the championship.
Well, he was riding Husky 500s the year before.
You know, but I mean they won everything worldwide. They did a T-shirt in Japan. I mean, they won everything. He won the 500. Yeah. Thorpe won in Europe. Johnson won the 250s. I mean, whoever was in Japan, it might have been Tofukuji, I believe it was. They won everything worldwide. It was an unbelievable year.
Yeah,
And I remember Kenny Clark, you know, he was a Yamaha manager at the time. Ironically, the guy that didn't hire me how many years before, but I remember him telling me in uncertain terms that you guys are going down as soon as this production regulation, you and all your money and fancy equipment. I was always a bit offended to that mentality because, you know, money doesn't always buy championships. I mean, it doesn't hurt, it certainly can help, but I mean, it has to be hard work, and it has to be, you got to be smart at the same time, right?
Well, yeah, Kawasaki was investing. I mean, their bikes were also pretty trick, and I mean, Wardy was making it happen, but not to the extent that Honda was, and their bikes were certainly pretty trick. I've seen some of them. Norm Bigelow brings them out to some supercrosses every now and then, and they were pretty trick, too.
You know? Very trick. I mean, I remember Kawasaki was experimenting with 4-speed gearboxes and 3-speed gearboxes for Supercross, and all those guys, all those factories, I mean, they had some very smart engineers, and they also had some good team management and good team technicians, like you mentioned, Bob Oliver and John R. and Roy Turner and
Rick Ash.
A bunch of guys, Rick Ash, I mean, there's a lot of talent in all these factories, and it was very competitive at that period of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So but as good as the 86s were, 87s might have been better. Rear disc brakes and, you know, sort of a refined style. I had 87. I loved it. I mean, I was just a kid, but I had an 87.
Yeah.
Awesome bike.
87 was a refined 86. As a team, there was a couple things that started to happen. I mean, we talked about Johnny doing well over in Europe, and that was his last year in 86. And maybe it was, you know, we had started to become... We had a lot of success in the early 80s, and then all of a sudden you've got three guys, and now they've all got agents, and now their demands, and, you know, the Japanese also, they went through a recession, and I think at the end of 86, they almost finished 1-2-3 in every, it wasn't even first place, it was 1-2-3 in every category. In that Supercross, that Bailey and Johnson had the dogfight of the decade,
Anaheim,
which was Anaheim 86, I mean, we got 1-2-3 and 5, I believe Mickey Diamond got 5th. It was crazy.
Right. Yeah.
But and so their agents and, you know, their demands, and all of a sudden they started to lean the team out, and Johnny got let go for 87, which broke all of our hearts because he was an original member and you know, part of the family and all that. But you know, and then right after that Ricky gets hurt
David.
Well, I'm sorry, right after that Bailey gets hurt.
Right.
And then Ricky gets hurt, and there was a period of time, I remember, and you probably don't because we regrouped pretty quick with Stanton, which was totally unexpected, but there was a race I was at after Johnny was let go, Bailey got injured, Ricky got injured in the National, and I was at a Supercross in Detroit, Michigan, and we didn't have any riders in the main event.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
But then, like... You know, you pull Mickey out of nowhere, Husky 500s, and he's winning.
Yeah.
And he leaves, which well, I did one of these with him, and he tells me it was a massive regret. You know, he took the money from Yamaha. He leaves, but then Stanton comes in, who's just sort of this hardworking farm kid. RJ gets hurt, and all of a sudden Stanton's winning. You know, he's the man now. So
I remember there was a race in Atlanta, and you know, if you don't do one of these podcasts, it was one of the best races ever because, you know, Ricky was dominant, although Bailey was a fierce competitor in 86, you know, but Ricky was the guy that year. And Jeff Ward was a fierce competitor, and, you know, there was other guys, but, you know, Ricky was clearly the guy. And, But going into the following season, you know, Bailey was pretty focused to he did not like Ricky being the number one guy. I mean, he was kind of a Yamaha guy. You know, your first marriage or your first, you know what I mean? The association between Yamaha, even though he's a support guy,
right?
You know, Bailey felt like one of the original Honda and Johnny, and, you know, so Bailey was pretty focused on not allowing that to become too comfortable, that status and that championship for Ricky.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he got hurt just soon after that. But the story where I was kind of going with that, and I got sidetracked, was Stanton was kind of brought in for, I don't want to say filler, but, you know, he was kind of a sidekick, but he was, you know, Ricky liked him, and Ricky was lobbying for him, and he was Ricky's friend, you know, to some degree, and, you know, we all liked Jeff, we all, you know, and it was, for an amateur guy, there wasn't that many factories that actually had amateur riders campaigning 500s, and Jeff did that. We kind of needed that, you know, in the larger displacement class. You know, we had Johnny previously for the 125, and then we had Mickey. But anyway, my story is, for right after Ricky got hurt, that series was wide open, and it was for anybody to win. And it really, Stanton stepping up and taking control of the championship was, it floored me. It was as big as Magoo winning four motos in Europe.
Yeah, really,
I mean, there was Guy Cooper, and then there was Ward, and there was Tischner, and there was five or six guys. Go back and look at that year at the race in Atlanta, Georgia, and I don't think anybody knew, once Ricky was out of the picture, who was supposed to win that year.
Right.
Or that at that point in time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It wasn't like Jeff was clearly the second best guy or anything like that.
No, he wasn't even at all. And, man, I think Jeff just manned up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Now's as good. It might be premature, but it's as good a time as any. And I'll give Jeff. Jeff was really strong at that point in time. I mean, you know, he had a really good team behind him, and he had a good relationship, good tutelage. Ricky helped him a lot, especially in the earlier. As soon as Stanton started to win races, that relationship fell apart pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was going to ask. That was one of my list of questions. How was that when RJ got back from his wrist injury? I mean, he was...
It was terrible. I mean, it's one of those things to where a smooth team is a team to where no one's a threat to each other, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm the number one guy. You know, if you went 5 years later when Jeremy was winning, and then there was a Doug Henry who was a damn good rider, but he was good in outdoor, and he was good in the 125, and then there was a better balance.
Right, right.
And there was much more synergy. When Ricky came back, oh, my gosh, it turned into a terrible situation. I mean, not that Ricky shouldn't have come back and regained the position that he left.
Right.
But, you know, he was injured. He wasn't riding at the same level. But, you know, he had this, you know, he was trying to defend that status, you know. And then Jeff had stepped up, right?
Right.
But is Ricky going to be supportive of that, or is he going to help Jeff? You know what I mean? It's an awkward situation, you know. And Jeff, does he want to let it go? I mean, he's just trying to do what he's told to do and expected and paid to do, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you throw Bale comes into the picture. I had the champion. I had three guys that thought they were the number one guy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my gosh, it was terrible. And, you know, it's not like you didn't appreciate any one of them, but it was hard to handle.
And then also, too, talk about picking up unknown riders. You pick up Kurdowski in 89. Three-digit guy, and he wins the 125 national title for you, you know?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Again.
Kudrowski, yes, that's right. And Kudrowski, Jeff got along good, and Kudrowski kind of fit in. You know, he was a real blue-collar, hard-working, you know, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. He was a great guy for the fit of our team, got along with, you know, Jeff. And, again, that all became, even with Kudrowski, it was when Bale came on the team, I think he had a really hard time sharing the limelight, whatever you want to call it. I'm not trying to bag on it, but Bale's very focused on Bale. He's an individual, very strong-willed individual, very manipulative at that point in time individual, and it created a lot of headaches for me and Kudrowski and Stanton and everybody involved. I mean,
yeah, like
just to try to balance all that out.
Let's talk about that a little bit. In 90, now you have Bale, Kudrowski riding 125 Nationals together. You got Bale, Stanton, RJ riding 250 Supercrosses together. And the mechanics were warring because Dan Bentley, a friend of mine, told me, you know, they were war. What was the worst incident? What was the worst fire you had to put out between everybody?
You know, it was all bad. I won't even sugarcoat it. I mean, the tension within the team, you couldn't have cut it with a chainsaw. And I'm not trying to be theatrical here, but, man, it had a lasting – I'm sure that period of time had a lasting impression till this day on everybody involved. It was, you know, it was everything that we were trying to do in the 80s and the pressures of winning. And, you know, I think at the time, originally, it was the team, right? It was, you know, it started out being for America, right? And then it was the team, and then it almost turned into the individual, right?
Yeah.
And then I couldn't have had three – you know, it wasn't like I had three guys that were number one championship level guys, and it was going to be a train wreck, and it truly was. And the tension, oh my gosh, the tension between Ricky. You know, I mean, ultimately Ricky tried to come back and really is risked. I mean.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate for Ricky. I mean, that whole thing. I mean, it's fortunate for Honda that we were able to have guys like Stanton step up. And boy, Jeff, there wasn't anybody that did. Talk about stepping up. I mean, not only did he win Supercross, and not only did he win, I mean, he picked up exactly where Ricky left off.
Yeah, and
but he went over to Trophy de Nations, and he single-handedly dominated those events, and then and pulled it out of the bag on not one occasion, but almost every occasion. You know,
right.
He was the guy that, you know, ended up being the star that won it for the whole group. You know,
And how history might be different because RJ. Until he broke his wrist, he had won six out of seven Supercrosses. He was dominating, and in an instant, breaking a wrist, his career changed. And who knows how good Stanton would have been, right?
I think it would have changed. The whole dynamic never would have changed like that.
Right.
Of course, Stanton would have gotten better, but was he ever going to? I mean, you know, Tommy, I'm not calling Stanton a Tommy Croft, but Tommy Croft was an exceptionally talented rider, but Tommy Croft never beat Marty Smith, you know?
Right.
And, you know, if Marty wasn't there, Tommy Croft, I think he won Trans Ams against, you know, Roger and everybody, right? Yeah. I mean, Tommy Croft and Puyallup Washington back in the 70s would come from behind, and he had unbelievable rides, right? But, I guess I'm trying to say that there's a dynamic or and I think Ricky really got shortchanged on that deal. I mean, he was really set up to win for years.
Mm-hmm. Now,
probably Stanton, it wouldn't have been nearly as easy. I mean, for sure he would have progressed, but I don't think it would have been quite the same dynamic, and you know, I might have been wrong there. Maybe it would have been a year or two later, and it would have been the same situation, and one of them would have gone to another team because they wanted to win or something like that.
Now, Len, let's get the real story as much as you know, because I've done a podcast with Kudrowski, and I did one with Bale, I actually did one with Bale and Stanton on the same time on the same phone.
Yeah.
But now, Cliff was modifying JMB's 125, and it was better than Kudrowski's because Shane Nally didn't quite have the same tricks as Cliff. And then when Bale got hurt, Kudrowski got Bale's motor, and now he was even madder because he realized that Cliff was doing cool stuff to Bale's 125.
I think I'll make a blanket statement by saying Bale. Yeah, I mean, and it's not even isolated toward that engine. But, okay, I'm sure there's truth to what you're saying.
Yep.
But Bale was an exceptional development rider. I mean, and a lot of guys are really fast, but Bale knew exactly. Now, maybe what he liked didn't directly apply to because of riding style or whatever, right?
Yep.
But, I mean, Bale, black and white, knew what he needed as a tool to win races, and he could articulate that. This is what I want. Here's the weakness. And that's really good for, you know, Cliff is also an exceptional engine tuner. I mean,
right.
he's a he tinkers and he refines and he. That's sometimes that's the best development is that level of incremental, detailed refinement, right? Mm-hmm. And those bikes were immaculate. And but I would say that but Bale was paranoid. Anything that he had, any testing, you know, a lot of times I would have Bale just. You know, I'm a conceptual guy. I mean, I'm trying to make all the Hondas better. I'm trying to raise the bar for chassis development, raise the bar for suspension and engine and balance. And you know, it's a weapon, right? It's corporate war. You're trying to up the ante, and Bale being one of your best tools, you're going to utilize it. And there was times where he would test something, and then I would say, well, you can't have it right now because we don't have enough, or I don't know what it was. And you know, he didn't like that role. He didn't like being the guy that, you know, and he probably even went overboard. I mean, he was very paranoid about being used or abused that way, right? I'm the guy with all the brains, and then you're using me to give that technology to all these other people that are trying to beat me, right?
Right, right.
So, yeah. Yeah, what you're probably saying with Gadrowski's engine, there was some truth, but I'll also say Bale didn't like anybody. You know, he didn't like Stanton. It wasn't Kudrowski. It was anybody. It was Ricky. It was Stanton. It was Kudrowski. Anybody that was going to get any recognition on a Honda is not going to have good things at that point in time.
And then,
you know,
also, too, you know, like Roger was kind of a Bale guy, a big supporter of Bale, and you were trying to put fires out everywhere.
You know, I really was trying to put out the fires. And even in Roger's defense, and people are going to say I'm a little bit biased here, but what are you going to do with Bale? Roger's European and Bale's European, but look at the talent. Are you going to race against that? Do you want to just, you know, Japan didn't want Bale to come to the United States.
They didn't,
I mean, Japan
right,
was telling me not to talk to the guy, but if he's going to come, I mean, and he already is a Honda guy, don't you want him under your umbrella? I mean, even with all the trouble.
Yeah.
Do you really want to be, you know, he won championships, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do I really want to be racing him on a Kawasaki? I mean, I didn't. I think it put Roger and I in a very difficult situation. I mean, and I know Bale probably used or communicated with Roger. You know, he's European and French, and I mean, but I mean, he chewed on me plenty, too. I mean, Roger wasn't the only guy being chewed on.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, he breaks his arm. He's out of the title chase. He was leading the points, breaks his arm, comes back. You have to bench him because he says he's not going to ride for Gadowski. Can you talk about that day a little bit and how that went
down? Sure. But I'll make a comment that, it's my waiver or my excuse is that Bale had a history of he is super motivated on he can't be stagnant. At that point in time, you know, that guy was very strong-willed in what his goals were. And when he won the 125 world title in Europe, he didn't defend it. He went to the 250.
Right.
When he won the 250, he did not defend it. He came to the United States. He came to the United States without the promise of a works-level ride. I mean, Roger lent him his van. You know, I think Roger might have borrowed a practice bike, I mean, a production bike, and Bale just wanted to come to America and race. Now the United States had become the premier form of racing. I mean, it wasn't enough to be a world champion, right? You had to come here and win Supercross, and Bale wanted to be, he wanted that level of recognition, that level of status. So I'm saying that, so after he, and he did that, ultimately, everybody knows the story. I mean, he won the 250 Supercross, and that was his goal. He never set out to win. And what did he win that year? Was it 250 National and 500 National the same year? I forget.
Yeah, he won 91. He won all three classes. And then,
he won all three. Yeah. And you know what? If you ask, I'm sure he didn't. He wasn't even focused on the outdoor.
Yeah.
I don't think he even really cared that much. And the outdoors kind of like fell on his lap, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
he never won a race.
Most,
he never won a race. Huh? He never won a race in the 250 class that year. He just won.
No,
the,
I mean, the I don't even think. I remember. I mean, I remember him like being focused beyond belief to win the Supercross championship, and I remember him, like, as far as his general demeanor, he was, like, making a big joke about the other championships, like, well, if nobody wants to win, I'll go, you know, okay, that's, I mean, one of the races was in, hey, do you remember the big flood race in Hangtown?
Yeah, Hangtown.
Where
the
levee broke?
Yeah.
I mean, it was, and everybody was going to protest and all, and Bale, you know, what the hell? I mean, he didn't care if the race, he looked at it as an opportunity, like, you know what, if everybody's going to wimp out, I'm going to freaking ride, and I'm going to, and he rode it like, I think John Dowd did really well, and, you know, a lot of people broke down. I think Stanton broke down. But I think Bale, it probably helped, it certainly improved his chances of winning the title, and he rode that thing like he stopped before the water crossing, and would look and like a trials rider and pick the best line, and so I guess my point, after he won 250 Supercross, he, you know, he won those other titles in 91, but that guy was out of there. Even though we had another year with him in 92, that guy was focused on going to Europe and going road racing.
Yeah, like he never stood still, huh? He just conquered and moved on. Conquered and moved on.
And at the end of the 91 season, you know, we all have to go to Japan, and he starts saying, well, I'm not going to go to Japan unless, you know, you get 250 Works Road Racers, and unless you get me a road race contract for after, you know, all this stuff, right? I'm like, man, I have zero. So I'd be spending 80% of, I mean, he's the champion guy, number one guy, and I was, you know, trying to line, motocross didn't even have that level of influencer status with road race. I mean, it was pulling some major strings, but then we finally set up the road race truck and the track, and in the middle of the motocross test, everybody shut everything down, and the other riders were highly ticked off about all this, by the way.
I mean,
it looked like the JMB show, and they were second fiddle, you know, and he ran off to do the, oh, man, he was happy. I mean, he, oh, my gosh, that made his day. But my point being, going into the 92 season and getting injured on the 125, that 125 championship, if you put it in terms of how competitive was that relative to winning everything in 91, that was a walk in the park, right?
Right.
But he was in – I just remember him being totally preoccupied and not taking – setting up the bike seriously and coming out and testing and, you know.
Right.
In my eyes, he got injured because he wasn't as focused.
Because he was winning.
I hope that doesn't come off as a cheap shot, but that's really the way I viewed it. And so, therefore, once that level of a talented of a rider didn't win that championship, I think he started to change all his attention to all these other things, you know, Kudrowski and everybody stealing from him and the team, you know what I mean, taking advantage of him and all this stuff, right? I mean, oh, my God, it was sick.
So you come to him, you go to him, and you say, hey, I need you to pull over if Kradowski's behind you.
So this was kind of before texting and before emails, and I kept sending him telexes or faxes or I forget what, but, you know, how's it going? And, of course, I'm trying to express concern, but because of the history of some of the problems we had with Stanton and Supercross and you know, Ricky Johnson. I mean, I knew, and the relationship with Kudrowski, I mean, you know, Bale was going to come back for Bale, and as the manager of the Honda team, I needed him to help Kudrowski. And I, you know, I asked him about his physical condition and his arm and all that, and he was being very elusive and not answering directly and hard to get a hold of. And you know, I'm still trying to show compassion and concern and all that, like, you know, you want to, but at the same time, I've got to win a title. And I'm like, so finally, I don't even really get to talk to him about it before the morning of the event. You know, the French press is there, and he's finally in his truck, and I have to jump up there, and it's unfortunate. I mean, it's not that I didn't try, but he knew exactly what he was doing, right?
Yeah,
he was there to win a race and prove a point.
And he was avoiding you because he knew the news that you were going to tell him. I mean,
of course. You know, and I'm like, I go, JMB, you know, you're giving me the runaround. And, you know, on a personal level, we're friends and we respect each other, right? But on a professional level, you know, he's got a different objective, and I just said, you know the situation, and you know, I mean, if it comes down to the team or somebody or you having to help Mike, we got to help Mike. And he goes, it's never going to come down to that. And I said, you're right, and I hope it doesn't, but, you know, but if it does, I got to know that you're in that corner, you know. And he's like, and real adamant, it'll never be that. You guys try to orchestrate all this stuff. It'll never purely come down to, you know, you controlling all those elements. I said, you're probably right, but if it does, are you going to be there for me, right?
Yeah.
And the answer was no. And I said, I can't tell you how much I respect an honest reply. You're not racing.
Yeah.
And It was simple as that, and it wasn't easy. And I think he accepted it, and it created all this big hoopla. But I think that, and unfortunately, he had to come all the way from Europe and the whole deal. But I mean, I just couldn't go through that again. You know, have him foil a championship for purely selfish.
So how did he take it? He was like, "All right, cool."
No, he's not going to be all right with that, but I think he understood that. Of course he didn't like it, and then the French went ballistic.
Uh-huh.
The French press, oh, my gosh, they, you know, and he's the 91, and he's this, and he's the guy, you know, they couldn't believe it. And I said, you don't understand. I remember Xavier, some of the guys from Moto Review.
Yep.
You didn't understand. You know, that's like asking somebody of John Michelle's status to eat shit, you know, for that, you know, because of the relationship
like
and all
Jesus,
that. And I said,
like Jesus of
yeah,
Jesus
but it's for the common goal. I have to do that every day. I mean, I don't call it quite that same terminology, but I mean, there's things you have to do because you have to do it, right?
Yeah.
So that's the deal. And sometimes you like it. Sometimes it's not purely about the individual. Most of the time it is. Yeah. I mean, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, when I spoke to him on the podcast about it, he was like, they said I could not ride. I said, okay.
He totally was. Exactly.
Not upset. Not upset.
I think he would, and of course he would rather not ride than help. I mean, it's always a sensitive thing. I mean, look at the Bob. Did Bob like, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Bob never liked it. You know, you asked me before if Bob minded helping Bailey. I also don't remember Bob minded. He minded, you know. It kind of depends on the relationship of those two guys, right?
Yeah. Bob made it super obvious to everybody.
Oh, my God. Bob wanted to go on record. He wanted to get paid, and he says I didn't pay him. I swear I did. But anyway, and he wanted the recognition of, well, I was the baddest guy. I got hurt, but it would have been mine. You know?
Right. Yeah, funny. And in 92, what's funny is if you look back in the record books, and I wrote a story about this, Bale missed some races in 1990, but he was still the fastest guy in Supercross that year. If he hadn't got hurt, he might have won the 90 Supercross title. He might have won the 90 125 title. And in 92... it was a sleepwalk, huh? Like, just, you couldn't get through to him? That was it?
I just want to say he was preoccupied. I mean, I think Bale was gone. In my mind, of course I wanted him to be the same guy, but, and even the Supercross Championship, you know, oh my God, all the stuff between him and Stanton?
Yeah.
I mean, he was night and day at that point in time better than anybody on the track.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he gets pushed off the track. He blames it on Jeff. I mean, it never should have come down to the last race, right? But
in
my mind, he was preoccupied. You know, you can't, if you knew Bale, I mean, his whole being becomes consumed with these goals he makes for himself, right? And his whole being was consumed with riding a road race bike next year. And I talked to the Gilera guys, and if Honda's not going to do this, then I'm going to do this, and I'm going to get this, and I've got this, you know.
Yeah.
He was possessed, you know.
And then L.A. Coliseum riding behind Bradshaw for a long time, refusing to pass Bradshaw, who was clearly feeling the pressure of the title. But the 92 Supercross title for Stanton, that was pretty nice for you. Pretty unexpected, I guess, going in the last round.
Oh, my gosh. It was also all the tension of the Bale thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now the Bale, you know, the whole thing where, you know, Jeff had a shot now after the San Jose race, you know, and Bale getting pushed off or run off the track.
Right.
And then now it came down. I mean, Bradshaw had the point advantage going into the Coliseum, and I think Jeff just put his nose down, and Jeff always just does what the best he can do, and the cards fall the way they can fall. I mean, you know, I don't think Jeff didn't try to manipulate a race. Jeff never tried to play mind games from what I knew of Jeff. I mean, Bale could manipulate races, manipulate people. I mean, you know, he could read and play. It was a chess game to him, you know. But anyway, going into that race, I would say that there was also some things with Stanton. I don't think Stanton was as fast that year, even though Bale was the dominant guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jeff had some problems. He lost a lot of weight, and his training had changed. And
yeah.
I'm not bagging on, but I want to say he was struggling a little bit. I mean, Bradshaw was the new up and coming guy, and he was fresh and spunky and cocky, and he was kind of the new Hannah, right, of the '70s.
Right.
And I thought the championship was won going into the Coliseum. And, I mean, of course, we're going to go through the motions. And,
yeah.
But, oh, my God, it was drama beyond drama. I mean, you know, Bales trying to sabotage Jeff, Bales trying to help Bradshaw, the whole Suzuki team, Cooper, Tischner, forget all the guys. Four guys come behind the truck. Dave, we want to talk to you. Cooper, you know, rode. We had a great relationship when he was on a support and then worked Honda ride. And, you know, there was a lot of riders that didn't have a good relationship with Bradshaw, and those guys were like, everybody loved Jeff, right? Jeff didn't have any enemies on the track. Mm-hmm. Bradshaw had some.
Yeah, and Cooper gave up.
Those guys were like, Dave, we'll do, you tell Jeff, we're going to do whatever we can to keep Bradshaw back, and he won't come around. That's Cooper talking, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if he's behind me, he's not coming around.
Oh.
And, you know, and I was like ready to cry. I mean, I'm like, this is just too much. I got other teams that want to help. I got my own team, you know.
That doesn't want to help.
And the whole element of Bradshaw kind of season up like that. I mean, who'd ever seen that? I mean, even if you're not having a good day, there was something going on there. And then, you know what I mean? I mean, there was some real deep-seated, you know, it's only speculation. I think I've read some, but not all, of what he said about all that. But my gut feel is it's one of these child prodigy things where the parents drag their kids through, you know, going to make them a star, and it's all for the parent, really, right?
Yeah.
It may not be really from the heart of the individual, and I don't know. I think it had something to do with that. I mean, it was just too much pressure for. I mean, he was a tough guy outwardly, but I think it was too much.
And then Dan Bentley said that Coliseum, that day at the Coliseum in practice, him and Bale got into it again. Bale skidded in front of him or something and kicked up roost on him. I don't remember.
You know this thing you're talking about called Kudrowski, and talk about Red Bud Michigan. I mean, it was 24/7 with Bale. I mean, it was just part of his MO. It was nonstop. I mean, he was effing with, and it wasn't even in your face. It was, those guys were fit to be tied.
Yeah.
And then Roger and I are like, you know, Roger has a tendency to believe Bale. I'm like, this is all too funky. I don't believe the guy's an angel, right? I mean, I'm somewhere in the middle, right? I mean, I'm trying to keep everybody happy, but I don't believe. You know, sometimes there's people that just stir up drama, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of their makeup, you know.
Yeah, Bentley said he was so mad, and that added to the drama, you know, and to be you at that time, I couldn't imagine it.
Oh, man, it was not. That's why I'm bald today, you know. I mean, that was a stressful period, and I said it in our earlier interview that I really think that that it took its toll on Jeff. I mean, I don't know why Jeff retired at 25, other than everybody involved in that whole era was worn out.
Right.
I mean, they were worn out. I think it was all of the 70s and half the 80s, and it was just too much. I mean, you know, it was racing. I don't want to get overly dramatic here, but you know, it's hard on the family. It's a lot of travel. And then you got all this drama on top of it, and you know, you got pressure from the factory at that time. They wanted to win. I mean, they always want to win. Every factory, every effort wants to win, all the sponsors. But back then, it was not a secret that, you know, these big corporations were, you know, they had it out for each other, and we were just the pawns trying to play that out.
Right, and it had to have been just drama, I guess.
Yeah, it was drama. It was unbelievable. I mean, and after the race, Jeff drops his bike, and they hug, and they break board. I mean, everybody, you know, Mike Gosser is one of my favorite, you know, but to have that level of emotion, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And racing brings that out, of course. I'm not saying that Mike doesn't feel that every championship, every race.
Right.
But, my gosh. I think Manny probably felt like taking a 5-year hiatus after that event was over.
He did quit soon after that to go sell tools in Idaho or something.
You know, he did. I'm not kidding you. I think everybody just decided that, you know, they didn't want to go down with the ship, and life was too short. It was tough.
And then, maybe one of the reasons Stanton retired was by the time he retired, he was about 125 pounds. His vegetarian diet, as he's told me many times, didn't quite work out. But anyways, moving along. So in the form of Diamond and Holland and RJ and Bale and Kudrowski, you get lucky again, or not lucky, but You signed this kid named Jeremy McGrath for 93. And
yeah,
and wow,
you know, that was a lot of fun. And you know, Roger and I, again, we did this year a lot of times. You know, we have still today a very good friendship, a very good working relationship. I mean, we're not working together right now, but I'd say at that point in time, you know, it was, a lot of these things were conceptual, like, well, Honda's only going to give us this amount of resource, whether it be equipment or budget. And I think, you know, they had been looking for a corporate sponsor for years, and I was asking Jeff Sirwall, but in any case, this particular team, we did this, I called Mitch Payton from Pro Circuit, and I'm like, look, you know, we got to make something look bigger than just another Honda support team. I mean, I can fund a lot of it, but you got to make it look. You got to. So Mitch got all wound up in the concept of, you know, he's friends with Troy Lee. Troy Lee started doing artwork and painting the trucks with, you know, they had a relationship with Peak Antifreeze, right? The big mountaintop with White Peak. And I think I had a bid for a couple of riders. Jeremy was a solid selection. I mean, he was, I think he might have been third place coming out of the previous season. But, I mean, maybe he was second. He was solid. But I don't know that people at that time would slate him as the next, you know, star guy.
Yeah, I definitely don't think so, yeah.
And in any case, you know, of course Solid works, and I think a few people, Cowie and a few guys, were kind of bidding for somebody that could be in a solid contention to win the West Coast title. But, you know, we put together kind of a factory-level deal for Jeremy, but it was kind of run through the Mitch Pro Circuit Peak Antifreeze team.
Right.
And I picked two guys. I picked Swink and Jeremy. Swink was the wild card just because I'd seen him at a few events. I liked his style, and I kind of liked. He was a little cocky and a little, you know, he reminded me a lot of Johnny O'Mara. He was a little volatile, I thought.
Yep.
But super, super talented. And then not a lot of experience really at that level, you know, more on the amateur level. And then I think Roger picked Lamson, and I think he also picked Buell.
Yeah, what a team.
But in any case, we did a photo session for that year, and I remember, who's the guy? There's a guy that does all Honda's press kits and does a lot of the photography, mm-hmm. Ken Bariki. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and you know, of course, at that time we had Vail still riding in Stanton, and I remember Ken Bariki, and he'd been involved with helping Honda promote and do press kits and all this stuff years and years. And I remember him calling me, which I thought was kind of strange, going, that Jeremy kid, there's not one, but usually they got to look through hundreds of photos, right, for a press kit.
Yep.
And he goes, there's not one bad picture of that guy. and I'm not bagging on Stanton, but you'd probably look through 100 pictures and then you round it down to 3 or 4 or 5, right?
Yeah.
And Jeremy, that was the beginning. I mean, he was unstoppable on the 125, and then the whole transition to the 250 made history, right?
Yeah, and he told me that him and his dad were pissed because they thought they were going to be on factory Honda, and here they are on some Yahoo Pro Circuit team.
Yeah. No, and that's true. And I guess, it had to come push to shove. I mean, I probably would have angled that. I mean, we had a bunch of talent on the team and all this stuff, but I mean, Jeremy for sure deserved that level of ride, and I tried the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was, I'm not saying visionary or anything, but I think I was trying to make the best of, you're balancing all these balls, right? You got the corporation going, do more with less, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
So, and then they're trying to find outside sponsors to come in. Well, now look at the sport, right? I mean, in a way, that Peak Antifreeze thing kind of kicked, you know, Jeff Glass did some of that with Surf Soap, and,
right.
You know, we had, and then after the Peak Antifreeze, we did the 1-800 Collect thing with the factory team, but we were trying to kind of get that going, and that was a total facade. I mean, I think Mitch Payton and I kind of, it was fun trying to make such a big deal, or it looked like it was such a big effort from Peak Antifreeze, when in reality, I probably funded 90% of it, and they put in $50 or something, or I'm sorry, maybe $50,000. But.
Yeah, no, exactly. Was one of your regrets, and I'm sure it maybe wasn't your decision, but was letting Mitch go. You know, he still talks about how shocked and how disappointed he was that Honda could not offer him a deal for that 93 season. What went down there?
No, it was you know, there was a lot of elements. I mean,
yeah.
Honda, I think, I'll make a blanket statement, and this isn't bagging on Honda. I think that, you know, Honda's big, and the name of Honda, you know, I think they viewed that as a value to somebody like a Mitch who's running a business or an outside sponsor. Like, I mean, they viewed the value of whether it's your, if you have a dealership or whether you have any relationship with us was going to be a value to somebody that was running a business like Mitch.
Right.
And I think so Honda was like, okay, we're going to do this the first year. I think it was a theoretical position, right? But
yeah.
Then over time, you're going to carry more of that weight. And I think Honda's image of how long it would take for that transition was probably much more aggressive than the reality of which Mitch could absorb. And then, you know, it rapidly turned, you know, Mitch could only do, it went from a four rider to a two rider to a to another manufacturer, right? And I was disappointed. I'm not blaming anybody else, but I was disappointed because it's water under the bridge. But look at Mitch. I always viewed him in the aftermarket in the motocross industry as having. He's got his finger on the pulse, whether it be riders or what needs to develop, and he's running a business, right? I mean, so he was able to, you know, talk to sponsors much differently than the way I was spending Honda's money, right? Mitch is trying to get people to support the effort, not give all of his money away, and, you know, and develop hardware and win championships, and he's got a few of them on the wall today, doesn't he?
Exactly. And also, too, you as a racer turned mechanic, and even though you're maybe a manager and a little bit delving into the corporate world, you can see the guys delivering wins and titles, and you're like, this is what we want. I mean, this is the bottom line. But
Rogers, again, very close friend of mine, a very close friend, and there's a handful of guys that I think, but I think the importance of having somebody in that position or the right person in that position, Rick Ziegfelder, another one for Factory Connection. But, I mean, having the right person, the importance of that crew chief, maybe it's in all sports, maybe the guys that's a coach for USC or football or the Laker, you know what I mean? I would say in this industry that a lot of people, or there's a lot of efforts put together. What we need, it's the mechanics of the whole thing. We need trucks, we need motorcycles, we need riders, mechanics. You know, they can put all the elements together, but it doesn't work, right? Why doesn't it work? I mean, even companies with a lot of money to throw at it, they still don't pull it off. Why is that? And I think it's because those people like Mitch and Roger, those positions, the importance of having the mentorship and the guidance, even if it's what are we going to test this week? It seems like not that big of a deal. Or how are we going to refine? How are we going to improve? You have to, a lot of times everybody's got, you got 15 guys on the team and they all want to go 15 different directions, right? How do you somewhat, you know, be somewhat compassionate and considerate, but you got to keep that focused, right? Anyway, I think it's pretty clear there's a few guys that do it really well, and then there's a bunch of other people that don't understand it.
Well, to this day, I wrote a column about it in Cycle News. I lament about it to different people. We've had teams come in and out, and I can honestly say a lot of times the reason they fail is because they hire their buddy to be a manager, or they hire an underqualified guy to be a manager, and they don't realize how important that is. Okay, so McGrath wins. He's winning everything. Lampson wins. Henry wins. Pretty much everything Dave Arnold touches is winning. When did you get out of racing and why? And talk about sort of the end of your racing career.
Before I answer that, that team was the most fun. You know, we came from something that was the most
disaster
environment, and that team you just talked about with Henry, I mean, it was such a joy his to work with, the relationship that Doug and Jeremy had, Lampson, just a really good team, and it was really hard for me to walk away from that, and you know, it's still to this day, there's some elements I miss within racing, but for me, you know, I work for a big corporation, and I do have a family, and I think it's a whole lifestyle traveling and doing this week in and week out, right?
Right.
And you know, you got to balance all this stuff in life. You know, you got to balance your personal time. How much do I get to ride my bicycle? Which, you know, all those things, when you're racing, there is no, the priority is racing, and that's it, right? I mean, especially at that level. At that time, I don't know how it is now. I assume it's the same, but, you know, I couldn't let Honda down. I couldn't. I had a lot of responsibility. I had a lot of pressure. And I, but it was like I'd been doing this on the road, traveling 35 weekends out of the year at least, mm-hmm. or more. And I got this year, you know how they give, corporations give you awards for you've been here for 5 years or yeah. whatever, right? 10 years. Yeah, and I got this 20-year award, and it was like a light went off, went on, and it was like, that's it. I mean, it's... and I also felt like the sport was starting to change, or even, you know, I was always more of a techie, geeky, you know, I was really a hardware guy, really. That's what I enjoyed was the development and the hardware, and not that you still can't do that now, but production regulations slowed that down to some degree, and then yeah. I felt over time Japan starting maybe to back off just a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. that... I have, and it maybe it was a sign of the times, like, you can't really sustain that level of, even the financial, but, you know, now the sport's changing, now it's getting more television and sponsors, and I think the focus is changing, and that's all good, and I think that Honda was trying to make an investment not only in their own hardware and technology, and but the sport, right? They wanted the sport to grow. They wanted sponsors. You know, they, of course they want to have all the championships, but at the same time, you know, they enjoy the competition. They enjoy the sporting of it all, and they wanted the sport itself to flourish, and maybe it go the way of some of the other sports. And maybe for me personally, I enjoy working directly with engineers on new concepts and new engines, and I think... It, well, I don't know. I wasn't really a camera guy or a high-profile guy, or maybe not even that much of a social guy, you know. Right, and I think some of the technical challenging things started to, you know, some of the satisfaction I got from those elements started to become less. And then maybe some of the pressure, you know, I don't know. It started to change, and I was probably, when we were doing it, but... you know, Honda was alive, and his project leaders, you know, he was bitch-slapping them around, and they were bitch-slapping me around, and that was a different deal, you know, and yeah. It changed enough to where it wasn't actually that anymore, right? And so
I think that's... Also, too, as a techie guy, you were probably pissed that MC used the same frame and motor every single year.
Oh, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Yeah, not really. I mean,
you were like,
of course, you get a little bit of pressure. You know how companies. I mean, all these things are supposed to be better every year, but not really. I mean, actually, I think I really enjoyed, or even proud of the fact that we tested so much, and I think we understood that Jeremy had a specific riding style, and that chassis was unique to that riding style. I mean, you can't say it wasn't a good match. It wasn't just luck. I mean, it fit. Yeah. So did the power band. Yeah. But I can tell you that Stanton hated that bike. You know, Stanton hated that chassis setting. Stanton hated that engine setting, you know, because...
Right.
And we would... You know, you're working with engineers trying to find out, well, why is that? I mean, you have all this telemetry on the bike, and one guy says, wow, this one's got really good bottom and big hit and a lot of power. And the other guy goes... It has no bottom, no hit, no power, right?
Right, right.
So that formula that was created for Jeremy was it was a really good formula.
Hard to argue with it.
It was very hard to argue. Oh, how do you argue? I mean, and it's not that they didn't challenge it. Every other year, they were like, okay, we got this new stuff, you know. And Jeremy's, you know, he was a good guy about it. He'd try it, but he's like, nope. I'm pretty comfortable with this thing right here. So.
Yeah. You know, Bob Oliver told me one time too, there was a year in the mid 90s, I believe it was in the 94, YZ250s were pulling every hole shot with Chicken and Larry Ward and Kyle Lewis.
Yeah.
They were pulling every hole shot out there, and they had engineers come out and look at the bike. And the way it delivered the power off of the starting gate with the amount that it would dig versus the amount it would move forward, the relationship between the pivot, the wheel, the frame, they could never duplicate it. They could never duplicate it with another model. you know?
Yeah.
It's just funny that way. It's like the smallest stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know what's fascinating about the whole sport, and it's exactly what you just said, and that's when you talk about the techie geeky guy, is that thing you're talking about, I mean, of course, at some level it's a science, right?
Right.
But it's such a dynamic. I mean, all those elements have to be in harmony and in balance, and, and you know what I mean? It's like whether it's the balance of suspension character, the dynamic balance of the chassis, not to pitch or to pitch enough, or have enough weight transfer for cornering, but enough weight transfer to the rear for traction and to stay flat off the jumps. And it's never ending, you know, trying to, you know, it's easy to, somebody wants to improve cornering character, right? But how do you do that without ruining stability or pitching in the whoops? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's and all those things that you commented, Bob Oliver commented, those are, you know, it's the best tuners, and I think it's what some of these guys, that we, you know, whether the Mitch or Roger, I think you have to kind of understand all those elements, and your mind has to be mechanical enough to understand, to actually relate to the equipment and the dynamics of how all of those issues are in harmony or work together, right?
Right, right.
And I think a lot of times it's even difficult for pure engineers to understand that. They need guys like, well, you know what I mean?
It's
sometimes hard for them. People, you talked about some of the bikes being developed, but and sometimes those developments are led by purely theoretical, you know, you have all these really smart guys with PhDs out of Tokyo University, right? And then, but you know, and they go, well, we want this bike to have a mass centralized whatever, right? But still, the best bike is the best balanced bike, and you want to improve maneuverability or whatever it is without hindering any other element, right?
Right, right, yeah. It's such a balance, you know. It's incredible that you were such a point leader for all of that too, between the racing and the production. I would definitely think that you have a better handle on it than most people walking this earth, really. You know, it's pretty crazy.
I appreciate that, but what they also say, you're a figment of your own imagination, right?
Yeah, so. Maybe that's it.
Thank
you, man. We'll wrap this up shy of 2 hours. I could go on and on and on with a guy like you. It's fascinating.
It's fun. Thank you for having me on, and it's fun talking about it. And we'll do it again on another issue or related issue someday.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much, Dave Arnold, for coming on the show for part two. And make sure everybody listens to part one. Also, there's some good information in that. And, thanks again, Dave, and we will see you around.
All right, Steve. See you at the races.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point to where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The daughter, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Go Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pit and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die.